Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. America is currently in the midst of a second fossil fuels boom thanks to the new techniques of horizontal hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. In fact, America is poised to pass Saudi Arabia in the next decade as far as oil output goes, and the gas potentials are even more optimistic. But every boom can be tempered in some way, and environmental concerns are at the top of that list, with worries from everything from groundwater contamination to seismic events. My guest today does a comparison of that particular environmental threat to the new technologies of America's other fossil fuel, coal, which is mountaintop removal strip mining. He'll be lecturing on the environmental impacts of both as a part of the University of Tulsa's National Energy Policy Institute lecture series tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the University of Tulsa's Helmer Hall. My guest today is the lecturer, biogeochemist Dr. Brian Lutz. He's currently a postdoctoral associate at the Duke University Nicholas School of the Environment, and he'll be joining the faculty of Kent State University in the spring of 2013. He'll be lecturing again tomorrow night as part of the National Energy Policy Institute lecture series, and he's our guest today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Brian Lutz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're going to be speaking at the NEPI lecture series tomorrow night, and you're looking at the two major sources of domestic energy production for electricity. That's natural gas and coal mining. And you're actually comparing the environmental impacts of hydraulic fracturing, mountaintop removal, coal mining. I think it's important to keep in mind with all the concern about hydraulic fracturing these days that the alternative is coal mining. And both have some negative environmental effects, but are they comparable?
That's right. So currently in the United States, we're witnessing a major revolution in how we're producing energy from the earth, particularly oil and natural gas. And thanks to recent advances in hydraulic fracturing, as you mentioned, that's the process by which we drill down into geologic formations that have previously been inaccessible, and we extract natural gas and oil from these formations. And there's been a lot of concern about the environmental impacts of these new practices and whether or not the environmental impacts are worth the economic benefits that we're gaining. But oftentimes we're considering these new practices in isolation from some of the current and existing and previous practices that we use to produce energy. And we think it's increasingly important that we put the new practices in perspective of the old practices so that we can make more informed energy decisions for how we're going to shift our energy portfolio down the road with these new and emerging resources.
Now, you hear this a lot when you hear about hydraulic fracturing. We're reaching formations that were inaccessible. And really what the inaccessibility was the material really just wasn't conducive to going up a pipe, right?
Exactly, yeah. So
you're looking at shale, like it's basically a semi-solid formation.
Sure. Shale is a very low porosity sedimentary rock that can contain a tremendous quantity of organic matter, of natural gas, of natural gas liquids, of oil, but it doesn't flow through that low permeability matrix. And so this is where hydraulic fracturing has been key, because that's the process by which we drill down to those low porosity formations. We can drill horizontally through those formations so that we can contact a greater amount of the area of the formation. And then we inject the fluids, the hydraulic fracturing fluids, at very high pressures to fracture that low porosity matrix in order to get the gas and oil to flow out of that formation so that we can recover it.
So when you're saying high pressure, you're saying like a fire hose?
Much, much higher than that. Some of the largest pressures that we put fluids under, it can be as high as 7,500 PSI, so pounds per square inch. These are tremendously high pressures.
So compared to hydraulic fracturing, what's the current state of coal mining? Because here in this part of the country, we don't have a lot of coal mining, and I think probably most people think of coal mining as you go down a shaft, maybe a mile down, and there'll be a whole network of tunnels. But in fact, surface coal mining has made a major comeback, especially in West Virginia and parts of western Pennsylvania. And this really has a devastating environmental effect.
It does. So let me describe the process of mountaintop mining in a little bit greater detail. So surface mining generally, the ability to access coal from above the ground surface rather than through deep tunnel networks, has been around as long as the industrial coal industry has existed, for about the last century and a half. But there are particularly extensive near-surface coal seams in the central Appalachians, so southern West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia. And these are in very remote places. But over the last four decades or so, we have developed the transportation infrastructure that we need, the road networks, the train networks, to move coal out of this region. And we've also had increases in technologies like machinery size that has enabled us to move tremendous quantities of earth, much greater than we have in the past. And so since about the 1960s or so, we've seen this rapid expansion in surface mining. And the extent of the mines is increasing to where, rather than small strip mines or pit mines, we're now literally removing the entire tops of mountains. So, for example, we can remove several hundred feet of material that might be overlying a coal seam. And much of that material then can't be placed back on the mountain once the coal is harvested, simply because it won't stay there. It erodes too quickly. So a lot of that material has to be placed in neighboring valleys, and that's the process of valley filling that's often in the news. And so it's really just been in the last several years that we've seen this rapid transition from the amount of coal that we get from underground to the amount that we're getting from above the ground or from surface mines. And now we're getting about 50% of our coal on the East Coast from these surface mining operations.
Really, 50%? That's quite a bit.
It is. I mean, to put a few numbers to it, since the 1960s, estimates range a little bit, but we've cleared as many as 5,000 square kilometers of land for surface mining in the central Appalachians. In the area of West Virginia and Kentucky alone, we've mined an area larger than the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. A lot of folks are familiar with that area. It's really a tremendous area. Something around 5 to 6% of the total landscape in this region has been mined.
Now, with the fill going into valleys, what is the environmental effect of that?
Well, so the environmental impacts are many. There's the consequence of directly burying streams. The EPA has estimated that over 2,000 kilometers of stream channel has been buried in the central Appalachians. That's directly buried underneath material. But then there's also the consequences of what happens downstream of these mines.
Well, and the water still has to go somewhere, right?
Exactly. So precipitation hits this landscape. And for anybody who knows anything about chemical processes, for example, we can think of just dissolving salt in water. If you have very coarse salt, it dissolves slowly. But when you break the salt up or grind it into a fine powder, it dissolves very quickly. And so that's essentially what we're doing with the landscape, is that we're reducing mountains that only have a limited amount of surface area that interact with precipitation. We're reducing that to relatively fine rubble that fills these valleys. So when it rains, rainwater percolates through these large piles of fill, and that material weathers very quickly. And so the streams emerge carrying extremely high concentrations of dissolved salts, dissolved ions, that come from weathering of that parent material, the rock that once made the mountains. And a lot of the work that we've been focusing on is just how far downstream do those chemical pulses propagate through the river network. So even though you mine an area upstream, how are the folks downstream affected from those mined areas?
I assume we're doing lots of testing on the water that's coming off these piles, but you know, I think compared to the American West, where there's mining, there's usually the chat piles left around are full of really heavy metals, things that are really detrimental to human health. Is it the same in the Appalachian chain, or are we looking just at granite products or things like that?
There are specific elements of toxicity, particularly in the central Appalachians. Many folks have heard of issues surrounding acid mine drainage, and so that's when streams become very acidic. The pH is very low, and that is more common to Pennsylvania, Ohio, and northern West Virginia, where mountaintop removal mining is less common, though it still exists. But where mountaintop mining is the most prolific is in the southern parts of West Virginia and Kentucky, and these are regions that have very different geology. The surrounding geology above and below the coal seams are often limestone. And so that actually leads to a very different situation where we have alkaline mine drainage, not acid mine drainage. So these actually become less acidic streams. And metals and specific pollutants have very strong pH sensitivities. So in the areas where mountaintop mining is occurring, we have different patterns of chemical pollutions. And one of the most common is selenium. Selenium is an element that has extremely high toxicity to aquatic life, and is something that we see very, very commonly in these mountaintop mining regions, and it's only soluble in these high pH systems.
Now, is most of the drainage for a lot of these valleys, are they going into like the Chesapeake, the Mid-Atlantic systems or river systems, or are they going into the Ohio and going down the Mississippi?
Sure. The mountaintop mining region does sort of span the Eastern Continental Divide. There is mining in both the Mississippi drainage as well as the Atlantic coastal drainage. Much of the area that we've worked in specifically drains westward, so towards the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm. And what are the measurements of the downstream effects from this mountaintop removal when these valleys get filled and the water seeps down and it starts leaching out, whether it's alkaline substances or acidic substances? What's the effects downstream?
So particularly with the issues surrounding selenium, we see a lot of fish deformities, so they can have a variety of physiological deformities, including spinal deformities. But even beyond that, we see very regular patterns of loss of sensitive biological life downstream of mines. And we don't necessarily know the direct mechanism of toxicity. Again, these mines leach such high concentrations of all types of substances that the water downstream of the mines actually can no longer be classified as fresh water. It exceeds the concentration by which we start to call it more saline water, above 500 milligrams per liter of total dissolved solids, mostly salt.
So it's really a broth in many ways.
Yeah, and so the mechanism of toxicity could be osmotic. It could be just introducing this much salt to a system. It could be specific methods of toxicity from specific constituents. But it's very difficult to measure the trace chemistry of a wide variety of potential toxins across such broad areas of the landscape.
And of course, you know, the thing to keep always and keep in mind is there's a lot of stream beds and there's a lot of water, and that concentration gets diluted as it goes downstream. But how far does the effects go generally?
That's a great question. So a lot of the work that we've been working on for the last 2 or 3 years now is trying to understand just how many of the streams in this region have been potentially impacted by mining activities. To answer that question, we relied a lot on satellite imagery. We don't really know. This is such a rural area. There are not good data of where the mines are located in the landscape. So we actually, with a group of collaborators, have identified where the mines are located in the landscape using satellite imagery. And then we paired those data with a vast network of water quality measures that have been maintained by the states in the region. And they've taken samples from both mined areas as well as non-mined areas downstream. And we tried to build relationships between how much mining was upstream of any given point and the likelihood that it was to exceed state or federal water quality standards. And when we did that, we found that just 5.5% of the landscape in southern West Virginia was mined, but that as many as 22 to 32% of all of the streams in the region are likely to exceed water quality impairment standards and also to have shown some significant loss of sensitive biotic taxa. That's really a staggering number, is that, you know, potentially a third of the streams in the region are already impaired.
Now, do those areas, for the most part, depend on surface water for their drinking water for the human population, or are they more likely to have wells and be drawing on well water?
Many of the people in this area, at least the closest people to the mined landscape, are on well water, and this is a highly rural, low population density region. Something that we are looking at is whether or not we can start to resolve changes in water quality near the larger cities in the region, and whether or not there's a sufficient amount of mining upstream such that we're starting to see deterioration of water quality that those cities might feed on. But that's still very much a work in progress.
My guest today is biogeochemist Dr. Brian Lutz. He is currently finishing up as a postdoctoral associate at the Duke University Nicholas School of the Environment, and will be joining the faculty of Kent State University at the beginning of the year. And he will be lecturing as part of the National Energy Policy Institute's lecture series on hydraulic fracturing versus mountaintop removal coal mining, comparing the environmental impacts. These are the two major sources of domestic production of energy, especially for electricity, coal and natural gas. And he'll be lecturing tomorrow night, Wednesday, November 28th at 7 o'clock on the TU campus. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk about how much research is going into the environmental effects of hydraulic fracturing. There are a lot of these high-pressure fluids that go down into these wells. They're then extracted. What happens to them once they come back to the surface?
That's a great question. So let me back up a second and speak specifically to the Marcellus Shale that's in the northeast U.S.
This is in the Pennsylvania, yes.
Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, New York. And this is an important shale play because it is extremely large. Some estimates put the extent of the Marcellus, the potential recoverable gas from the Marcellus, as being larger than all of the other shale gas plays in the U.S. But the Marcellus is also unique for another feature, is that the vast majority of wastewater produced from oil and gas activities in the United States is often injected back deep into the ground where it comes from, into essentially old vacated oil and gas fields. The Marcellus is unique in that this underground injection disposal is much more limited in the Marcellus region. In Pennsylvania, there's almost no underground injection wells, just a half a dozen or so. And in Ohio, there are more. But the infrastructure capacity to inject this waste back underground does not exist in sufficient quantity to handle the amount of wastewater that's being generated.
Is the water carried off-site?
It is. It's increasingly carried off-site. Early on, the wastewater was being taken to local municipal treatment facilities. So these are just the sewage treatment plants that exist in almost every town throughout the landscape. However, these facilities do not have the capacity to treat either the volume of waste that's being produced or the types of pollutants that are contained in these wastes. And so recently, Pennsylvania has essentially banned waste from the shale gas development going to these municipal facilities. In response to that, there have existed and there are increasingly being built these private treatment facilities that have different capacities, better capacities to handle some of the waste types that are being produced. These facilities operate much the same way that a sewage treatment plant does. They accept waste, they attempt to treat it, and they either release the treated effluent to a nearby river, or they send that water back for reuse, usually in another hydraulic fracturing job. There's been a concern that even these facilities are not necessarily well equipped to handle the type of pollutants in the hydraulic fracturing waste. And so Pennsylvania also has passed new legislation to limit the quantities and the concentrations of effluent from these types of facilities as they're being built in the landscape.
How closely regulated are these private facilities? Does the state have the proper regulation scheme in place to make sure that...
They do.
Yeah.
They actually have one of the most progressive regulations in the country. They've limited the concentrations of salts in these effluents to 500 milligrams per liter. That's very low, so you can't dump any waste into rivers that exceed 500 milligrams per liter from new facilities. Older facilities have been grandfathered in, but new facilities, there are very tight standards to try to limit water quality problems.
May I ask a question about the Marcellus Shale itself? Because I've heard talk of how this particular formation might be different than a lot of the shale formations where you're seeing fracking in other parts of the country, say Oklahoma, for example, or North Dakota or Wyoming, that there's something about the Marcellus Shale that is perhaps more fracturable or more, of course, we've been mining as far as drilling for oil this area for 100 years or more. You're hearing stories of methane plumes coming up through old oil shafts that people didn't even know were there. Are there some specific problems about the Marcellus Shale that are different from some of the other areas where we've seen hydraulic fracturing?
That's a difficult question to answer, simply because each shale play is unique, and my expertise really is constrained largely to the Marcellus region. I think one of the greatest issues that we face is simply the size of the resource. And this is important. When you bring up the idea that we have produced natural gas in this region for a very long time, that's true. And some of the recent work that we've been doing is focused on trying to put shale gas development, the environmental footprint, specifically how much water is being generated by shale gas wells, in perspective of what we've been doing in this region for the last century and a half. We do not have good estimates of how much wastewater is actually being generated by all of these shale gas wells in the region. So something that we've done recently is compiled a database of thousands of wells throughout the Pennsylvania region, and we quantified how much water wastewater they're producing and how much natural gas they're producing. And then we compared that to all of the conventional wells in the region and how much water the conventional wells are producing relative to the amount of natural gas they're producing. And we found something really interesting is that the shale wells are actually producing nearly three times more natural gas per unit wastewater than the conventional wells. And that's something that hasn't been reported before and that catches a lot of folks off guard, because there's become this perception in the Marcellus region, simply because of the sheer size of the resource and the amount of water that's being produced, there's this perception that the process of hydraulic fracturing is inordinately more wastewater intensive than the methods that we used to be using, and that's not true. Actually, on a per-unit gas basis, there's a smaller wastewater footprint for shale gas wells. It's just that there's much, much more drilling that can be done in the Marcellus formation than there is to access the conventional resources in this area of the world, as well as in other shale formations.
My guest today is Dr. Brian Lutz of Duke University. He is a postdoctoral associate there. He'll be joining the faculty of Kent State after the first of the year. He's a biogeochemist. He'll be comparing the environmental impacts of hydraulic fracturing versus mountaintop removal coal mining, which is one of the other ways we get domestic energy in this country, in the National Energy Policy Institute's lecture series to be held Wednesday, November 28th at 7 o'clock. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. In our last couple of minutes, I want to ask about some of your other research areas. One of the things you've been also looking at while at Duke is examining surface water systems in the wake of climate change, you know, especially being near the southeast. Of course, in the southeast, so much water for drinking water and for human use is from surface water. And, of course, there's been at least several cycles of drought in the southeast where you literally saw reservoirs nearly going dry, filling back up, going dry again, and filling up again. What have you been learning about that?
That's true. And so we have a series of papers that are in the process of being published on drought in the southeast. This has become a very important issue, largely because we've seen a lot of population growth in the cities in the southeast and increasing demand on pre-existing water supplies. What we've learned specifically is that the major droughts that we've seen in the last decade or so, in 2005, 6, 7, that have caused a lot of the concern, they are exceptional droughts, but we don't necessarily see a change in the frequency or intensity of drought systematically over the last 100 years or so. While these recent issues have captured a lot of attention, we don't necessarily know that we're going to see more events of this severity that are going to cause similar problems. We do, however, see that over the last 30 years or so, that the average amount of precipitation and the average amount of stream flow throughout much of the southeast has been declining. So even though we don't see droughts, we do see sort of a long-term decline in the mean over the last 30 years or so. And so it's pairing the risk that we're exposed to of future drought events, population growth and water demand increases in the future, as well as this decline, not in the drought severity, but in the inter-drought amount of rain that we're getting. And we're trying to pair all of those pieces of information up to assess what major cities are going to have to do throughout the southeast to meet their water needs in the coming decades.
How bad was it for cities in the southeast at the height of the last drought? I can remember seeing television reports of, you know, basically reporters walking on the lake bed. And,
sure.
And it seemed pretty severe at the time, especially when they were saying, you know, a city of, like Atlanta was getting their water from this lake, and, you know, I'm walking on the bottom of the lake.
Exactly. Yeah, and I mean, that's potentially problematic. They were down to just days. Now, I should say, however, though, that we've been working a lot with the Army Corps of Engineers, who manages several major reservoirs throughout the Southeast, several of which also supply municipal drinking water. Now, it's not the mandate of the Army Corps of Engineers to serve as sort of the maintainer of infrastructure for municipal water supplies. They can do that as long as it doesn't interfere with their ability to control floods and to essentially make rivers navigable for commerce. So these facilities that Army Corps operates, nonetheless, have some amount of water that can be used for municipal supplies and some amount that is allocated to other purposes. And something that we've been working on is when we get in these very critical periods of water shortage, how can the Army Corps, what capacity do they have to shift their allocation budgets so that they can meet immediate human needs versus maintain the water that they need to control river flows and some of the other functions that they are charged with.
Now, while you found no link between climate change and the Southeast experienced, is that something that we might have to look at down the road with the Corps of Engineers as far as their mission, as far as in a lot of their facilities, you know, communities depend on the drinking water?
Sure.
Facilities.
I do want to be careful not to go so far as to say that there's no link between climate change and stream flow. It's simply that we did not find an increase in the frequency of the most severe events in the Southeast. Again, climate change may actually be driving the long-term declines in stream flow that we're seeing with slow, gradual warming. We just haven't been able to see a change in the most severe events yet, and it may also be a limit of the data that are available.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, what we're working for is how Army Corps can change its procedural operations to sort of account for the exposure to risks that it wasn't structured to account for in the past. So, in other words, if there are new risks in water supply that are emerging with changing climates, is the Army Corps going to be able to essentially facilitate local municipalities by providing that drinking water, or are local municipalities going to have to consider alternatives such as looking into groundwater supplies or building their own reservoirs that are distinct from Army Corps facilities to meet their future water needs?
All right. We'll learn more about the environmental impacts of coal mining and gas and natural gas production here in the United States in the NEPI lecture series. Dr. Brian Lutz, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Biogeochemist Dr. Brian Lutz speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be lecturing tomorrow evening as a part of the University of Tulsa's National Energy Policy Institute lecture series. That lecture takes place tomorrow evening at 7 at the University of Tulsa's Helmrich Hall, and the lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.